This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for the week ending 20 May 2016 for Expressions of Peace, Personal, Powerful, and Heart to Heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace radio tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With global extreme weather as the organizing principle, Sequitur covers habitat destruction, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as a result of human activity. Sequitur moves from our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels to a place of acceptance of the natural consequences of those actions. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymphd. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. More of his work is linked at panina.org, or you can find him on SoundCloud. I'll open this week with the official April temperature records before I present an in-depth report on our built environments. Then I'll put the fire in Alberta, Canada, in a global perspective with a report on disasters and refugees, and pick up some loose ends on the too-big-to-fail insurance industry and its reframing of its so-called risk management services as climate change mitigation? Say what? In the second half of the show, I'll have a topical musical selection, a report on climate activism, and the Global Extreme Weather Report. Wonderground blogger Jeff Masters sounds like a broken record with his reports of broken records. April was the 12th consecutive month with the highest average temperature since record-keeping began in 1880, and the 7th consecutive month to exceed the 1951 to 1980 average by 1 degree Celsius or more, an unheard-of event prior to October 2015. Based on a sort of reverse computation of how cold it would have to be for the rest of the year to avoid breaking the annual record, Masters predicts that 2016 is virtually certain to be the hottest year on record and will likely break the record by a record-breaking amount again. The International Business Times notes that April 2016 is also the 369th consecutive month with average temperatures at or above the historical average. Yes, the last colder-than-average month in NASA's database was July 1985. Quartz interviewed Bill McGuire about his new book, Waking the Giant: How a Changing Climate Triggers Earthquakes, Tsunamis, and Volcanoes. This title totally vindicates my confusion about where weather reporting leaves off and natural disaster reporting takes over. McGuire confirms the deniers' contention that we are actually entering an ice age from the astronomical perspective, but he says we'll never feel it here on greenhouse Earth. Buildings account for 39% of U.S. energy consumption and 38% of U.S. carbon dioxide emissions, according to the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions, reports the Deccan Chronicle. However, with more than 62% of the U.S. population living in cities as of the 2013 U.S. Census, it becomes immediately obvious that we must not give up on our cities. Here are some highlights. The City of New York announced plans to retrofit its million buildings to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 2.7 million metric tons by 2050, the equivalent of taking 560,000 cars off the road. Transparent disclosure of required energy audits and annual energy consumption reports help owners to predict energy savings if they were to implement specific improvements. South Korea will achieve net zero energy on all new multifamily housing by 2025, but the Seoul metropolitan government is aiming earlier, for 2023. Singapore has created a toolkit to help landlords and tenants work together on green leases that set out environmental objectives for a building's improvements, operations, management, and occupation. Yokohama, Japan bases unit prices for energy on supply and demand. Urbanization is a global trend. According to a study reported in the Christian Times, 34% of the global population in 1960 lived in cities, but this had risen to 54% by 2014. And cities tend to be on the coast, and low-lying areas tend to be inhabited by poor people. By 2060, more than 1 billion people will live in low-lying coastal areas, the majority of whom will be Asians. Former mayors of New York, Paris, and Rio co-authored a plea published in The Guardian for federal authorities to, quote, help cities by removing national fossil fuel subsidies that undermine incentives for public transit and clean energy, unquote. They claim that worldwide, cities are expanding daily by an area the size of the island of Manhattan, and the direction this development takes is crucial in determining the future quality of life for our species. They call for pedestrianization of urban areas and predict that actions taken to reduce emissions will yield $17 trillion globally in reduced medical and energy expenses alone. They explain that outdated national laws prevent cities from utilizing tax revenues or from borrowing money on their own, and they point out that cities with control over their building codes are 30% more likely to have energy efficiency standards and benchmarks in place. This focus on localizing finance and regulation is especially interesting in light of a report in Bloomberg that the White House National Security Council has a senior director for resilience who is calling for tighter building standards so that ever more skyscrapers can withstand ever more severe weather without generating ever more claims against their ever more expensive disaster insurance. At the end of the report is an almost regretful disclaimer, quote, there aren't national building codes in the U.S. States and localities generally adopt common standards set by organizations that are part of the International Code Council, unquote. According to the Smithsonian, cities are heat engines due to the preponderance of reflective surfaces, yet carbon sinks such as trees make a very poor tax base. They explain that climate change exacerbates sick building syndrome, a constellation of symptoms including noise pollution, elevated carbon dioxide levels, fumes from toxic cleaning chemicals, and thriving mold colonies inside of walls and ventilation systems. Carbon dioxide levels are far higher in urban built environments than the global averages we hear reported, largely due to increased use of air conditioning. For example, office buildings tend to run between 600 and 1,200 parts per million, schools between 1,500 to 2,000 parts per million, and up to 4,000 parts per million in the passenger cabin of an airplane on the runway waiting for takeoff clearance. Such levels induce fatigue and affect decision-making. Mold triggers breathing problems, skin conditions, and headaches. Petrochemicals in common cleaning products react with naturally occurring ozone and increase levels of the terpene and aldehyde families of eye, nose, and throat irritants. Tighter buildings save energy to the benefit of the property owner who pays the utility bill, but they are toxic to those who live and work in the space. Noise pollution is an inevitable consequence of increased population density and has mental health consequences, especially for occupants who live with post-traumatic stress disorder or other anxiety disorders. In residential buildings, even the mentally healthy experience disrupted sleep patterns, which can lead to impaired cognitive and social functioning. Disasters create refugees. An analysis published at RPUBS of U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration data on 17 kinds of severe weather events from 1950 to 2011 shows that overall wind and storm are the most damaging weather events across all four outcomes measured: property damage, crop damage, fatalities, and injuries. Breaking it down by category, tornadoes have caused 8 times more human fatalities and/or injuries than any other single event, with heat and windstorm second and third. Inland flooding causes the most total damage and property damage, followed by windstorm and hail. Crop damage follows a different pattern, with cold, drought, and heat causing the most damage. Forbes weather reporter Marshall Shepard was shocked to learn that 90% of global disasters are due to extreme weather events, according to a report based on the Emergency Events Database issued by the Center for Research on the Epidemiology of Disasters and the United Nations Office for Disaster Risk Reduction that illustrates the relationship between the impact of disasters and socioeconomic status. I quote the executive summary in full. Flooding alone accounted for 47% of all weather-related disasters, 1995 to 2015, affecting 2.3 billion people, the majority of whom, 95%, live in Asia. While less frequent than flooding, storms were the most deadly type of weather-related disaster, killing more than 242,000 people in the past 21 years. That is 40% of the global total for all weather-related disasters. The vast majority of these deaths, 89%, occurred in lower-income countries, even though they experienced just 26% of all storms. Heat waves and extreme cold were particularly deadly in terms of the numbers of lives lost in each event, 405 deaths per disaster on average. High-income countries reported that 76% of weather-related disaster deaths were due to extreme temperatures, mainly heat waves. Overall, mortality from heat waves helped push the average toll from weather-related disasters up to 99 per event in high-income countries. In a study published last month in Geophysical Research Letters, Australian scientists analyzed data from 1,300 rain gauges and 1,700 temperature stations across the continent and found that the increase in flooding from severe storms is due to both temporal and spatial decrease in the storms in a warmer world, reports the Homeland Security Newswire. In other words, the same amount of rain is being delivered within a tighter radius in a shorter amount of time. 5,000 delegates from governments, businesses, and aid organizations will hear a detailed breakdown regarding refugee demographics next week at the World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul, Turkey, reports Voice of America. The Norwegian Refugee Council's Internal Displacement Monitoring Center reported last Wednesday that 27.8 million people were internally displaced in 2015, for an average of about 66,000 new refugees per day, bringing the cumulative global total to 40.8 million, the highest figure ever recorded. Of that number, 19.2 million were uprooted by natural disasters in 113 countries, mostly in India, China, and Nepal, and 8.6 million were displaced by conflict, mostly in Yemen, Syria, and Iraq. The Middle East and parts of Africa may become uninhabitable due to more frequent, more extreme, and longer-lasting heat waves. The Rural Debt and Drought Task Force has submitted 14 recommendations to address the debt crisis in Queensland's agricultural sector, reports ABC, including passing the buck for regulation of the banking industry to a ponderously slow royal commission and at the same time providing insurance subsidy inducements to that same banking industry. Sounds like a bailout to me. And speaking of the insurance industry, in the wake of the Fort McMurray fires, Canadian insurance companies promise both increased insurance premiums and tighter risk reduction requirements for coverage, such as drains that direct runoff away from buildings, devices to prevent sewer backup, covers for window wells, and fireproof building materials. To put it in perspective, imagine enrollment in an approved exercise program as a requirement for increasingly expensive mandatory hospitalization insurance, or if the provider could refuse to cover anyone who weighs 15% more than recommended by actuarial norms, already the case with some corporate employee benefit plans, by the way. Shall we finally internalize our risks and bring an end to an industry that profits from playing the odds on natural phenomena such as illness, death, disasters, and the weather? And speaking of the Fort McMurray fires, Alberta Agriculture and Forestry reports that the total geographic extent of the fires was 284,214 hectares as of earlier this week. Over 1,100 firefighters with more than 200 pieces of heavy equipment, 46 helicopters, and 29 air tankers are working on this wildfire, with more on the way. The weather remains breezy with no rain in the forecast. The Guardian reports that 2,400 homes have been destroyed. Martin Lukacs, writing for The Guardian, says, quote, "The devastation of Fort McMurray is the predictable outcome of arson," close quote. And he points out that a mere 90 companies are responsible for 2/3 of the global total of greenhouse gas emissions. He injects the same premeditated element into his scathing indictment of Big Oil as the Philippines has done in their suit against some 50 corporations, or as the state of New York and others have done in their suit against ExxonMobil. In connection with the New York Attorney General's investigation, a 1970 report by Imperial Oil, the Canadian branch of ExxonMobil, was discovered in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, that concluded, quote, "Since pollution means disaster to the affected species, the only satisfactory course of action is to prevent it," close quote. Lukacs continues, quote, "To remain mute about those responsible for this devastation is not an act of sensitivity toward the citizens of Fort McMurray. It is to stand idly by while these corporations move on to claim their next victims. To argue, as Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has, that making the connection between climate change and this infernal fire isn't helpful is not a gesture of statesmanly maturity, it is the prevarication of a political coward," close quote. Wow, those are strong words against an otherwise popular and charismatic leader. But Trudeau is guilty at least of supporting private profit at public expense, as estimated recovery costs from the disaster are coming in at around $10 billion taxpayer dollars. Now that's criminal. Science may not show a direct link between climate change and the existence of one particular fire, but there is no doubt why the blaze that devoured the Alberta town was so powerful. Mike Flanagan, a wildfire scientist at the University of Alberta, says, quote, "We have loaded the dice for more extreme wildfires. We attribute the increase in wildfires and their severity and intensity to human-caused climate change. We've been saying it for years," close quote. Today, twice as much land in Canada is being devoured by fires as in the 1970s, and that will double or quadruple again in the decades to come. A study published last year in the journal Science warned that the boreal forest is converting to a savanna. A new suit has been brought against Exxon in Massachusetts by the Conservation Law Foundation on behalf of a coalition of advocacy groups from Boston's least affluent neighborhoods, reports Inside Climate News. A letter delivered to Exxon by the plaintiffs on Tuesday, as legally required a few months before a lawsuit may be filed, alleges, quote, "The first significant storm surge that makes landfall at the Everett terminal at or near high tide is going to further flush your hazardous and solid waste into the Island End and Mystic Rivers and through those communities, and a significant rise in sea level will put the majority of the Everett terminal, including soils, groundwater, and treatment works, underwater. You know all this, and yet have not taken appropriate steps to protect the public and the environment from this certain risk," close quote. At the biannual Adaptation Futures Conference in Rotterdam last week, Queen Maxima of the Netherlands said that climate adaptation is essential to proper development, and development is critical in creating new economic opportunities that spell success for private sector entities, a.k.a. insurance companies, reports Ecosystem Marketplace. Queen Maxima called for more access to financial products for the poor people of the world and cited data from Kenya that shows that insured farmers are able to invest 20% more in their farms and earn 16% more income than uninsured producers. Say what? She wrapped up with the usual plea for sustained growth, quote, "Only when we work together can we ensure that development and equitable growth are sustained, despite the effects of climate change," close quote.
Christian doesn't ask what would Jesus do, well then I don't know what a Christian is. If a Buddhist doesn't ask what will Buddha do, well then I don't know what a Buddhist is. If a Muslim doesn't ask, what will Muhammad do? Well, then I don't know what the Islam is. If a human being doesn't question his actions, I don't know what a human being is. Oh, earthling, earthlings, our perception's gone astray. We think we own the earth and we treat her like a slave. Oh, earthling, earthlings, let's reevaluate our role in this experience and choose to change our ways. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, no. You know that I'm gonna sing it again. If a Christian doesn't ask, what would Jesus do? I don't know what a Christian
is. If a Buddhist doesn't ask, what would Buddha do then? I don't know what a Christian is. Muslim or not, what would Muhammad do? Then I don't know what Islam is.
And if a human being doesn't question his actions, I don't know what a human being is. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, our perception's gone astray. We think we own the earth and we treat her like a slave. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, let's reevaluate our role in this experience and choose to change our ways. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, your guns and bombs and armored trucks and realize that we are one. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, for we are here to love. Yes, la 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 love in this trip around the sun. Oh, earthlings, earthlings. Oh, earthlings, earthlings.
Infinity, two, infinity, one, one breath, one mind, one heart, one soul, one life, one God, one love. Earthing to earthing, being to being, infinity, two, infinity, one, one breath, one mind, one heart, one soul, one life, one God, one love. Earthing to earthing, being to being, infinity, two, infinity, one, one breath, one mind, one heart, one soul, one life, one God, one love.
One breath,
one breath,
one mind,
one mind,
one heart,
one heart,
one soul,
one soul.
Earthlings by Here to Hear from their self-titled 2011 CD. And I'll repeat the relevant lines from the refrain. Earthlings, earthlings, our perception's gone astray. We think we own the earth and we treat her like a slave. Earthlings, earthlings, let's reevaluate our role in this experience and choose to change our ways. Earthlings, earthlings, put aside your guns, your bombs, and armored trucks, and realize that we are one. Earthlings, earthlings, for we are here to love. Yes, la 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 love in this trip around the sun. Looking for a nonviolent direct action this week? Celebrate Guerrilla Gardening Week with Adbusters. The Culture Jammers recommend the following three actions in ascending order of risk to and level of commitment by the gardener. 1. Seed bombs are easy and inexpensive to make, and even easier to deploy. 2. Strategically plant a tree in a location that needs one, such as a riverbank, a highway verge, or a city roundabout, preferably somewhere you can visit regularly and do some minimal, unobtrusive tending. 3. Form a group and start a garden like my friends at Occupy the Farm in Albany, California. Learn from their experience under the Occupy the Farm tab at occupythefarm.org by clicking on How to Occupy a Farm. Remember, in order to count as a nonviolent direct action, your guerrilla gardening must be carried out in a public space. Occupy the Commons! In a speech in London last week, Naomi Klein, author of This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate, said that climate change could be, quote, the catalyst we need to knit together the great many powerful movements bound together by the inherent worth and value of all people and united by the rejection of the sacrifice zone mentality, close quote, reports the Irish Times. That same night, U.S. environmental sociologist John Bellamy Foster gave a parallel lecture in Dublin titled The Anthropocene and the Crisis of Civilization, Climate Change and Capitalism, in which he drew on Karl Marx's theory of a metabolic rift between humanity and nature under capitalism arising from the profligate use of natural resources. Kevin Anderson, climate scientist and deputy director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research at Manchester University, says that the Cop-Out 21 obsession with limiting greenhouse gas emissions is meaningless without a, quote, reordering of economic priorities, unquote. A BBC report concluded that planting trees is still a good idea in spite of all the failures in tree planting campaigns, from competition with the agricultural sector to unkept government promises to economic concerns such as the greater monetary value of trees as lumber than as members of living communities. But they will still fault farmers for holding on to productive agricultural acreage rather than planting trees, and say not a word about the public acreage that is given over to car culture in the form of highways and parking lots. I can think of no better example of Klein's sacrifice zone mentality than the way oil extraction is continuing in the Gulf of Mexico, even when it's been stopped off the wealthier eastern seaboard of North America and in the polar regions that offer other avenues for monetization. EcoWatch reports another oil spill, this time by Shell. This time, only 90,000 gallons have been released because there are no drilling operations at the Brutus platform. The visible slick was 2 miles wide and 13 miles long. Leaving defunct rigs unattended and at the mercy of the elements is common practice. Break Free has been the world's largest action against the fossil fuel industry, with their unifying theme of keep it in the ground, according to EcoWatch and The Guardian, among others, I'm sure. Here are some highlights from last weekend. In the state of Washington, large groups occupied the railroad tracks that transport oil to the refineries and shut down the rail line over the weekend. In Washington, D.C., 1,300 people demanded an end to offshore drilling. In Chicago, Illinois, 1,000 people protested a BP refinery expansion. In Newcastle, Australia, kayaks choked the world's biggest coal port. In South Wales, the UK's biggest open-cast coal mine was occupied. In Germany, Europe's biggest open-cast coal mine was shut down. In Indonesia and the Philippines, some 10,000 people protested a new coal-fired power plant in Batangas. Further anti-fossil fuel activities took place in Brazil, Nigeria, South Africa, and Canada. Cop-Out 21 is busted, according to The Guardian. Quote, many of the protests expressed alarm that last year's Paris climate deal, which committed nations to keeping global temperatures below a 2C increase on pre-industrial times, contained no explicit commitment to phase out fossil fuels, close quote. Despite repeated calls to ramp up the efforts toward the Paris Accord, only 16 countries have ratified the agreement so far. That means only one, in addition to those who cashed in on the Earth Day photo op. A report published this week by the UN Environment Program says aid to developing countries for climate change adaptation could reach up to $500 billion annually by 2050. This is, altogether now, higher than previously expected by a factor of 5. The World Bank projects that property damage from extreme weather events will reach $1 trillion annually by 2070, reports the Huffington Post. The combination of climate change, population growth, and urbanization has put an unprecedented number of people in the path of destructive weather events over the last 30 years, according to a report released on Monday by the World Bank's Global Facility for Disaster Reduction and Recovery. Deutsche Welle reports protests against King Coal in Germany and the UK, which present a facade of weaning off of coal while clandestinely profiteering from the needs of developing countries. And most surprisingly, in the Philippines, where resistance has increased since Typhoon Haiyan in 2013 to an industry linked with climate change, which in turn is linked to extreme weather events. Protesters claim emissions from 27 new coal-fired power plants could contaminate water supplies and fishing grounds and increase respiratory diseases due to particulate pollution and sulfur dioxide emissions for residents close to the power stations. Despite advances in renewables, the U.S. Energy Information Administration has warned that fossil fuels are on course to still make up 75% of energy production in 2040, with a 33% increase in carbon dioxide emissions from 2012 levels, largely driven by emerging economies such as China and India. Germany got called out for its continuing dependence on King Coal at the 10-day UN climate summit in Bonn last week and this week. In his opening statement at the World Climate Summit in Washington, D.C. earlier this month, even the World Bank Group President Dr. Jim Yong Kim said, quote, "If the world's governments, particularly those in developing countries, continue to increase their reliance on coal and other fossil fuels, we are finished," close quote, reports Voice of America. The report says that 155 companies have agreed to cut their planet warming emissions, including Coca-Cola, Sony, and Pfizer Pharmaceuticals. Speakers at that summit said that cost is no longer an issue. According to Jennifer Morgan of the World Resources Institute, a planet-wide cut in fossil fuel emissions of 80 to 90% is necessary in order to realize the Paris Accord goal of a 2C cap on global warming. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon will call another climate meeting at the G20 summit in China in September. The Libertarian Republic echoes my skepticism about the Secretary General's promise that rallying behind the Paris Accord will not only solve climate change, but the rest of the problems of the world as countries drop their age-old animosities and forge alliances on their newly discovered common ground. So, plant a tree this weekend, or some potatoes or bush beans, or a butterfly bush or bee balm for the threatened pollinators. Do it in service to life, with no attachment to the outcome, whether or not you think it will work. Do it, as Guy McPherson's Nature Bat's last guest this week, author and climate reality leader Ronnie Dam from Western Pennsylvania, said, because you can't not. The Federal Circuit Court has recommended that the state of Minnesota raise its social cost of carbon estimates to the federal standard so that Peabody Energy, possibly the world's largest coal company, can be held accountable for more of the costs of decommissioning their spent mines in spite of the protections afforded to them by their recent bankruptcy proceedings, reports The Guardian. It's hard to imagine how the state would enforce such a ruling against a fiscal entity that no longer exists. If we're not willing to bail out these monsters of our own creation, then we must be prepared to clean up the mess they leave behind, even at taxpayer expense. Nobody said it would be easy or even painless. In a plea for just transitions for fossil fuel employees in equal times, Sharon Burroughs says, quote, "We know there are jobs in action on climate, millions of jobs, with infrastructure investment projected to be up to $90 trillion by 2030. This means jobs," close quote. I followed the link she provided to a 20-page PDF of a working paper, where the first sentence reads, quote, About $90 trillion in infrastructure investment is needed globally by 2030 to achieve global growth expectations, particularly in developing countries, close quote. How does a need translate into a projection? And how does particularly in developing countries translate into jobs for privileged Americans and their union bosses? The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has officially declared the currently waning El Niño to be the strongest ever, according to Click to Houston. The Miami Herald adds that while its physical signs are weakening, it will continue to influence climate patterns through the middle of 2016, and its socioeconomic impacts will continue to strengthen until the end of the year. The United Nations Economic and Social Council met earlier this month, and Council President Oh Jun called for creation of a support and assistance protocol outlining coherent, coordinated, and integrated steps to be taken collectively that will ensure early and coordinated responses to future El Niño and La Niña events. Response is a euphemism for financial aid, just as risk management is a euphemism for insurance coverage. The Weather Channel reports that the 88 caskets that floated away from five graveyards in Calcasieu Parish, Louisiana, when the Sabine River overflowed last month, have been recovered. The caskets weigh up to a ton and were found up to 180 meters away from their assigned resting places. Parish Coroner's Investigator Charlie Hunter said, quote, "People just don't understand the power of water," unquote. Much of the region from the southern tip of Texas to New Orleans and as far north as Memphis, Tennessee, is at about 150% of normal rainfall so far this year. Indigenous Puyallup and environmental groups understand the value of the waters of the Puget Sound, where a proposed liquefied natural gas plant is being contested, even though it is far less dangerous than the methanol plant that was successfully resisted. And even though liquefied natural gas would provide cargo vessels with a far cleaner fuel than diesel, reports the Tacoma Weekly. In order to liquefy natural gas, it is chilled and compressed for more economical and efficient storage. This plant would store 8 million gallons of liquefied natural gas that would expand to 4.8 billion gallons of vapor if released. There is a short-term threat from the churning up of a waterway used by salmon to reach their spawning grounds, and a long-term threat from fire or explosion, accidental or otherwise. Puget Sound Energy claims that the impact zone in case of collapse or fire is only 550 feet, and that a burn-off would be harmless and easy to control. The resistance claims that the impact zone would be 3 miles, and that the effects of the fumes have not been adequately studied. The entire court case is centered around the relative safety of the plant to humans. There is no mention of its necessity or superfluity. Daily 24 reports that 2 people were killed when a tornado touched down south of Oklahoma City last Monday. Later in the week, several waves of storms hit Missouri and Illinois with damaging hail and a tornado, reports the National Weather Service. Farm futures report up to 50% of South America's bean crop ruined by excess rain, especially in northern Argentina and southern Brazil. Extreme rainfall at a rate of up to 30 centimeters per hour caused flooding that resulted in the deaths of 4 in Haiti and the evacuation of over 2,500 people in the Dominican Republic between 2 May and 9 May, reports NASA. New Zealand's South Island got pounded with severe midweek storms last week, including tornadoes and winds strong enough to topple trees and high-profile vehicles such as vans, campers, trailers, and trucks, or lorries, reports TVNZ. The system moved to the North Island over the weekend. Less glamorous than corals, the kelp forests off eastern Tasmania are being destroyed by warm water species swept south by the strengthening and warming East Australian current, reports the Sydney Morning Herald. Similarly, the dieback of the Gulf of Carpentaria mangrove forests is apparently linked to extreme weather but got scant media coverage. Coconuts Valley reports whirlwinds and 3 to 4 meters of floodwater last Wednesday, with damages valued in the tens of millions of dollars. 4 West Valley homes were completely destroyed. In the Solomon Islands, home to 500,000 people, 5 uninhabited islands ranging from 1 to 5 hectares are now underwater, reports the World Weekly. 6 others are threatened, with villages on 2 of them already inundated. 10 houses were lost on Nua Tambu Island between 2011 and 2014. Indonesia reports a surge in bird flu cases. According to the Jakarta Post, this illness waxes and wanes with the El Niño cycle, with more than a 15% increase among poultry in the first 4 months of 2016 over the entire year last year. Of the 199 humans diagnosed with the virus since 2005, 167 died. AccuWeather has reverted the UK summer forecast back to wetter than usual with seasonal temperatures, while the extreme heat I mentioned last week is predicted for the continent instead. The Express reports that an unusually cold weekend has nipped orchards in the bud after an unusually early spring brought them out prematurely. There is concern for apple, pear, and cherry crops. This week has seen 30°C temperatures, bringing the May average back into line to break 170-year high temperature records. Edie's blog quotes Environment Agency's acting chair Emma Howard Boyd. Planning now for the impacts of severe weather and a changing climate makes good business sense and can have immediate benefits. For instance, if businesses can keep trading during severe weather, they will not only retain customers, they may have a chance to win new ones. We want UK businesses to be resilient to extreme weather, to be prepared for future risks, and to seek opportunities where they can from a changing climate, close quote. Italy and the Balkans can expect drought with crop failures, high temperatures, and wildfires, while more northerly locations can expect frequent thunderstorms and only occasional extreme heat, predicts AccuWeather. Voice of America reports that 56 people were struck and killed by lightning in 2 days in Bangladesh last Thursday and Friday as a pre-monsoon storm followed an unusually hot, dry week. Last year, the entire pre-monsoon season saw 51 deaths by lightning strikes. The surge is being blamed on deforestation. Such events usually strike those who work outdoors. Reuters reports a severe decline in both the quality and quantity of Pakistani cotton due to drought and insects. Pakistan is the 4th largest producer of cotton in the world, and the industry employs 40% of the nation's industrial workforce. Heat-tolerant and drought-resistant seeds in pilot testing stages promise 30% larger harvests with 30% less water. The Pakistan Express Tribune reports strong hail and dust storms, and the Daily Pakistan reports that temperatures remained high for much of the week. The World Weekly reports 258 deaths from yellow fever in Angola from among 2,000 cases reported, with an undisclosed number of further cases diagnosed in the DR Congo, Kenya, and China. 2 supposedly unrelated cases were also reported in Namibia and Uganda. Reminder, this is one of those mosquito-borne diseases that we can expect to see more often in a warming world. Thanks to increased supercomputing power acquired earlier this year by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the resolution of the grid used by weather forecast models has more than doubled from 27 kilometers to 13 kilometers, reports Claims Journal. The U.S. Global Forecast System, along with other NOAA weather and climate modeling infrastructure, is free and available to the public. According to The Guardian, Somalia could benefit from more timely access to forecast information, with nearly 4.7 million people, or 38% of the population, experiencing acute food insecurity. Ethiopia is similarly affected. Democracy Now! Reports that at least 50 people were killed in drought-ravaged Ethiopia by flooding and landslides caused by heavy rains. In the Indian states of Jammu, Kashmir, and Ladakh, the nomadic shepherds could also benefit from more timely weather information, but ordinary internet and cellular signals can't reach them in the Himalayan pastures, reports India Climate Dialogue. Tribal Research and Cultural Foundation Secretary Javed Rahi says that hundreds of families have been driven to the cities and reduced to begging or unskilled labor due to climatic events or armed conflict. He wants the government to provide insurance for the livestock, so that the nomads will be compensated in case of disaster. I don't know an insurance company that would pay a claim for loss of access to pasture lands. Teachers report that Indian schools are having a hard time delivering the 220 days of state-mandated education in light of extra holidays that have been declared due to the heat wave, although administrators don't seem to think there's a problem, according to the Times of India. The temperature broke the 50°C threshold this week in several places with a national record-breaking high of 51 Celsius. That's 123.8 Fahrenheit in Falodi on Thursday, 19 May, and much of the country had highs over 47°C, reports Wonderground blogger Jeff Masters. Almost 3,000 people have required emergency medical intervention, reports SkyMet. Since the beginning of April, some 340 have died of heat stroke in Delhi alone. At Stand Up India on 5 April, Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced the distribution of 5,100 e-rickshaws for the metropolitan Delhi area. Cycle rickshaw pullers are reluctant to go through the licensing process until they see the rickshaws arrive and recharging stations provided, reports the Hindustan Times. 11 people have died, 9 were injured, and 6 are missing in Sri Lanka as a result of floods and landslides, reports the News Tribune. Some 114 homes have been destroyed, and more than 137,000 people have been evacuated. Viva Lanka reports that about 150 people in 3 villages in the Aranayaki division have been rescued in a separate landslide incident later this week. A 24-hour rainfall record was set, with 26 centimeters recorded, reports News First. At least 22 people were killed in a landslide at a construction site in China's Fujian province after a heavy downpour dropped 18 centimeters of rain in 24 hours on Sunday. Yabata reports that the landslide was due to the downpour, but I would argue that it was due to the construction. The fire department rescued 2 people and 14 were sent to the hospital for treatment, 3 of whom have serious injuries. China Earthquake Administration researcher Gao Zhengguo blames the increase in geological disasters caused by extreme weather on increased construction in disaster-prone regions. He says that China's current geological hazard prevention map is lacking, as it only shows places where disasters have already happened. The new CEO of Malaysia's biggest palm oil company will consolidate and intensify to recover from losses attributed to El Nino, reports Channel News Asia. But the Malay Mail offers a political and economic causal link between flooding and overdevelopment. Regional NGOs say that money spent on high-tech tunnels and drains is wasted as long as deforestation and hill-cutting activities continue. According to the Earth Changing Extremities blog, more than 1 million cattle have died in Mongolia due to the dzud, that killing thing that happens when a dry summer of inadequate forage growth is followed by a severe winter. It hasn't rained since last July, and this winter temperatures dropped to as low as -50°C for days on end. Snowfall covered up to 60% of the country and fell heavier than usual. Almost 250,000 people have been affected. Local importers say Thai coconut prices have doubled due to the ongoing hot spell in the region and rising global demand for coconut products, reports Channel News Asia. In Cambodia, hundreds of cattle have died and about 2/3 of the population is experiencing scarcity of drinking water. The new Philippine president blames El Nino and typhoon activity for agricultural losses and persistent poverty in the islands, reports the Manila Times. Pacific Standard magazine explains that oceanic dead zones and aquatic die-offs are a consequence of oxygen depletion, ranging from hypoxia or low levels of dissolved oxygen to anoxia or complete lack of oxygen. The first warnings were massive hauls of dead crab in the northeastern Pacific dating back to 2003. Since 2006, anoxia has become an annual event in the late summer and early fall and is working its way south. One cause is algae blooms in response to runoff of nutrients from agriculture or sewage. Another is that warm water can't absorb as much gas from the atmosphere as colder water. And another is a reduction in the mixing of deeper hypoxic layers with the warmer, more buoyant layers of the surface. These effects are intensified by displacement of dissolved oxygen by other gases such as methane from below or carbon dioxide from above. According to the Santa Fe New Mexican, oil and gas operations are the largest single source of methane emissions, with trash landfills, manure, gas produced by livestock, and coal mining completing the top five. Last Thursday, the federal government issued new rules regarding new installations aimed at reducing emissions 40% to 45% from 2012 levels over the next decade, with a similar set of rules for existing operations expected next year. Later this summer, the Bureau of Land Management will release methane capture requirements for new and existing operations on federal and tribal lands. Of course, environmental groups say the regulations are too lax, while the corporations say they go too far. Ocean hypoxia has been a harbinger of mass extinctions in the past, most notably in the end Permian die-off 252 million years ago. Then, as now, triggered by rapid accumulation of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere, the oceans became hot, stagnant, and inhospitable to animals, reverting to a primeval state in which microbes ruled. In addition to smokestacks and tailpipes, the exponential increase in wildfires is a major source of atmospheric carbon dioxide. Just as earlier layers of coal ignited in the end Permian, today we have tar sands and peat bogs fueling fires visible from outer space, most recently in Canada and Russia, and 6 months ago in Indonesia and Australia during their summer season. End Permian concentrations of atmospheric carbon dioxide may have been as high as 8,000 parts per million. Given the levels cited earlier in our buildings and vehicles, and given that the anthropogenic rate of release of carbon dioxide is still increasing, how? Exponentially, despite current consciousness-raising efforts, and is already about 10 times what was emitted by Earth herself in the end Permian, I take no comfort in the fact that our atmospheric level is only 400 parts per million. As recently as the end of the last ice age 10,000 years ago, there was a smaller extinction due to warming of the eastern Pacific, smaller in that reduction to only single-celled life forms occurred only from Alaska to Chile, and it only lasted 1,000 years. I am not prepared to argue semantics over whether this would constitute an extinction event or only a die-off. And if an extinction event, then an uppercase six maths extinction or only a smaller extinction. A group of scientists is embarking on a study of the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, the PET-M, which occurred about 56 million years ago, as a good case study for our present predicament, reports Eureka Alert. The onset of the PET-M brought extreme changes in Earth's carbon cycle with a resulting increase in global temperatures of 5 to 8 degrees Celsius. The carbon cycle is the interface between life and non-life, since carbon is the key component of all organic molecules, and yet is in and of itself an inorganic element. What if a mass extinction event is nothing more than a massive remineralization of organic material? I feel a bit more accepting of extinction when I look at the big picture and realize that extinction is as necessary to evolution as death is necessary to life. Thanks for following Sequitur on Expressions of Peace Radio, archived at panina.org. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston. Thank you.
dissolves all power through the needle's eye and ear. Follow it back to the zero field. There's only metaphors and puns. It tells us then that there is no seeking, 'cause what connects us is one.